Nightlife with Philip Clark on ABC Radio.
The killing fields in Cambodia, Auschwitz concentration camp in southwest Poland, and Ground Zero in New York, or Port Arthur in Tasmania. Some of you may have visited at least one of these sites out of curiosity, out of a sense of social responsibility, or perhaps a desire to pay respect to the dead. I wonder, what was your experience? And why did you go? Give us a call on 1300 800 222. Tonight we're looking at the phenomenon of dark tourism, visiting places of war and conflict, death and mass tragedy. What role do these sites have in relation to history, national identity, and our own sense of mortality? And how important is an expression of public grief for those who have suffered or lost their lives? And why, more intriguingly, is the dark tourism industry seemingly more popular than ever before? Joining me tonight, Associate Professor Elspeth Frew, who's Head of Tourism, Hospitality and Event Management at La Trobe Business School. Elspeth, good evening to you. Welcome to Nightlife.
Thank you.
And Leanne White, a Senior Lecturer in Marketing at Victoria University. Leanne, good evening to you. Welcome to Nightlife.
Good evening, Philip. Thanks for having us.
Well, it's a pleasure. It's an interesting concept, isn't it? An interesting idea, Dart. Why would we want to go to somewhere where horrendous things have happened, even in the recent past? What do you define as dark tourism anyway? Elspeth?
Well, dark tourism is when you actually go to a destination which is associated in some way with death or dying, or people have died there at that spot. And people are interested to go to that place because they want to feel close to the event. They want to try to understand what happened and how did it happen. And by going to that place, they feel closer to that event.
Leanne, your thoughts? What do you think of as dark tourism?
Yes, it's a fairly broad term in many ways, and certainly it is becoming a popular phenomenon. So it can include, as Elspeth was saying, visits to sites of death and destruction. It can include cemetery tours. It can include crime tours. You know, the most popular dark tourism site at the moment in the world is the site of Ground Zero, the World Trade Center 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
So certainly it's a growing phenomenon, and some people may be even in engaging in dark tourism and not necessarily realizing that they're doing it, and possibly not even calling it dark tourism.
Yeah. People may go for different reasons, I suppose, but there's probably an awful lot of straight-out voyeurism, isn't there? Elspeth?
In some ways it is, but it's in the past. So it's usually there's been a time delay between when it happened and when you go along and see it.
Hmm.
So for a lot of people, it's all about trying to understand what happened and trying to come to terms. So if you think about the different people who go to these sites, it ranges from people who have had first-hand experience of the event, then it's it may be the children of the victims, or it might be the grandchildren of the victims, or then it becomes a wider society. So depending on your association with the event and the disaster reflects different reasons why you might go there. So if you're trying to come to terms with a close family member dying, then that would be a reason to go there. If you're trying to understand what your grandparents went through, then you might go there and to visit the site. Or if you're interested from a historical point of view, you'd also go there.
Mm.
So there's different types of people going to these places for different reasons. And it's all about when it happened. Is it in your lifetime? Was it in your grandparents' lifetime? Was it more historic?
Mm. I mean, recently there were reports of two tourists in Berlin taking selfies at a place which I've visited, the Memorial to the Murdered Jews of Europe. They were slammed in the press because they were seeming to have the wrong response. Is that part of what these places are about too, having an appropriate response to them?
Yes, I think in many ways it's about respect. And it's about acknowledging what might have happened at a particular site in the past. So I suppose it's a bit like in the way that people generally don't take photographs at a funeral.
Mm.
There's a sense that at a dark tourism site, you may take some photographs of, say, graves at Gallipoli. But, you know, the smiling selfie is sort of not something that, I suppose it's about having good taste and respecting the space and respecting the place. And, you know, there is a sort of level of etiquette that does take place in these different places. You know, if you visit Anne Frank House, for instance, there's an understanding of what she went through during the war, and you might take a photo of yourself out the front of the building. But, there's certainly a level of what's allowable and acceptable socially, I think, in many spaces, including these dark tourism sites. And certainly that went beyond the realms of what other people.
Yeah, because, I mean, unfortunately, you know, us humans have a tendency to want a sticky beak, don't we? And we are attracted, unfortunately, I mean, a lot of us, to the gruesome and the morbid, because that's what it is. Is there a sense in which a lot of us go and see these sites for those reasons?
Yeah, there is a term, thanatourism, which means that you go along because in relation to death and mortality, and sort of coming to terms with your own mortality is one of the things that people have said that's a reason for visiting. And I think it helps you. There's lots of reasons. I think one of the things is some people visit certain sites at anniversaries because that has certain significance. So on the first anniversary, the fifth anniversary, 10th anniversary, you can go along and pay your respects. But it's also these things happen, but understanding them and understanding where they happened and how they happened, it's all part of understanding the disaster and as it unfolds. And if you think about the different types of disasters that have happened, there's wartime disasters, there's peacetime disasters, there's natural disasters, and there's like man-made disasters, as it were, that all have people dying for different reasons. And so you're visiting for all these sort of to try and understand how it happened and so on.
Mm. Yeah, I suppose that, you know, the idea of natural disasters is something, these are things that happen and they're part of life. I mean, you can't say that human misery imposed upon other humans is part of life. It may happen, but wanting to go and see it, I guess there'd be various reasons. James has texted me to saying, I've visited both Auschwitz and all the places relating to the Cambodian genocide. Extremely moving and the grim reminders for history not to repeat itself. And I suppose for many people that would be a reason, wouldn't it? The idea that this horror should not happen again, and that therefore having it, keeping it alive and keeping people visiting it, is a way to help ensure that it doesn't.
Yes, definitely. It's a reminder of past events that haven't been positive events. And so if you take, for instance, Port Arthur, you know, the massacre that happened there was certainly something that wasn't, there was a need to respect the place and to understand what happened there. And consequently, the Broad Arrow Cafe was demolished, and there's a more respectful memorial nearby with the cross and the reflection pool, and putting an event like that into the context, because that's an interesting site, because obviously you've got the historic dark events that have happened there, and then obviously the events of 1996 on top of that as well.
Let's get to some calls. John from the Blue Mountains. Hi, John.
Hello, Phil. How are you?
Yeah, very well, thank you. Where did you... Yeah. You went to Nagasaki in Japan, did you?
Yes, I was visiting... My daughter lives in Fukuoka, which is not far from Nagasaki. We went down for a day trip, and one of the things that you've got to see in Nagasaki is the Peace Memorial Museum there, which goes through in quite graphic detail the events around the dropping of the atomic bomb and the effects it had on Nagasaki and the surrounding regions. It's a very, very sobering display. And I guess it was it's something I wanted to say. I didn't feel like it was a dark. I didn't go there out of morbid curiosity, but it's an event that happened in the city that you can't avoid, and they, not proudly, but they use the history of it as a I guess, as a message to the world that this would never happen again.
Mm. What were your own thoughts when you were there? Were you, was it curiosity or was it something else?
I guess I'm fascinated by the history and finding out what happened and how the effect it had. Like any museum I've been to around the world, I like to understand things. So it's a very well laid out scene there in the museum. Then you can go around to the park where the bomb actually detonated, the center of the mm-hmm. where it detonated. And there's a whole display there as well. It's turned into a peace park, and they've got all kinds of tributes there and aspirations that the world would be at peace rather than war.
Mm. Yeah, okay. Thanks, John. Thanks for sharing that. My guests tonight are Elspeth Threw from La Trobe University, La Trobe Business School, and Leanne White from Victoria University. We're talking about dark tourism. My texter says, I went to the catacombs in Paris. Amazing, fascinating, a little bit creepy. I loved it and wouldn't have missed it for the world. Made me realise how young Australia is. Les from Chippendale says, I went to the Museum of the Nanjing Massacre in China. Yes, I've been to that, Les. I went to pay my respects to those who were brutally murdered by the Japanese soldiers before World War II. It was very interesting and very solemn. There were no signs in English, alas, but the displays were vivid enough to understand. Philip in Fitzroy in Victoria. Hi, Phil.
Oh, Phil. I'm another Phil.
Yeah. No, hi,
yeah,
Phil.
I had the privilege of recently going to the killing fields in Phnom Penh, Cambodia.
Yep.
And I'm not an easy crier, but for about 2 hours I cried, as it made me realise we come from the best country in the world for 2 hours walking around it, not being a boy.
What's actually there, Phil? What do you walk around?
Graves.
Right.
And they pointed out, you wear headphones, and of all the headphones that describe everything, and it had rained that day, and there's still clothes being unearthed.
Mm.
And it just made me cry. You know the saddest part? They had a fence around it called the Killing Tree, and I'm about to cry now, actually, where they bashed the children's heads against this tree to kill them.
Mm.
And then as the grant, I mean, I don't mean to do it as travel to all dark tourism, but there's a giant tower there with all of the clothes of the thousands killed, and it helped me realise that we live in the best country in the world after what happened to them.
Yeah, we do. Yeah, we do.
Yeah, yeah. It was so saddening. I'm not a normal crier, but...
No, I can understand that.
I had tears for 2 hours.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Phil, what would you say to people who were thinking of saying going there? Would you say it's a place you ought to go to, or...?
Yes, definitely.
Right.
Makes you realise how lucky we are to be Australians.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thanks, Phil.
The saddest thing I've ever seen.
Thank you, Phil.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Yeah, just back to you, Elspeth and Leanne, and also to my listener as well. I went to visit Auschwitz in Poland. I don't know whether either of you two have been there. It's an incredibly horrendously sad place, as you can imagine. I had my young teenage daughter with me, and I was in two minds as to whether I should take her, really, because I genuinely do think that you need some life maturity to absorb a story like that, of the horror of it. And I did think long and hard about it. Eventually, I did take her, thinking that she'll take from it what she does. You know, what are your thoughts about that?
Well, I think I was thinking about the previous caller and how there's a continuum of dark tourism. At one end, there's a real extreme things that you can see, which is about violence and murder and so on. And then there's kind of greyness before that. So in some ways, you can take children to sites of dark tourism, but they can just see maybe the headstones.
Mm-hmm.
And then maybe later on, as an adult, you can see the gory the pictures and so on. You can understand the violence involved. So, but to actually go to those kind of places, it does make it more real. So you can read about it in the history books, but to actually be there, particularly when you understand the size of the destination of say, for example, how large the prison was, or the actual gas chambers were quite small. Those kind of things really brings it home to you, which you can't really get from just you know, looking at internet sites or, you know, reading books?
No, no. I mean, one of the immediate things I remember taking away from Auschwitz when I went there was we were there in January, middle of winter. And, you know, from the moment you step out of the car and enter the site and you see what conditions people lived, were brought to and lived in, you wouldn't last more than a few days in a place like this, okay, even without being deliberately put to death. You know, the conditions were so horrendous. Douglas in Canberra makes a good point. He says, where does war cemeteries and battlegrounds fit into this notion of dark tourism? Just thinking of this in terms of Anzac Day. It's a good question. How do we locate that, do you think, Elspeth?
Well, certainly battlegrounds and battlefields and sites of war often and are generally located in the dark tourism area as well. So there's a category. There is a category called battlefield tourism, but dark tourism often incorporates battlefields, so sites such as Gallipoli, you know, the Somme and other places are certainly considered to be dark tourism. But as mentioned before, sometimes people are going there for historical reasons or going there to find out more about their ancestry, genealogy. So they're not necessarily always positioning them as a dark tourist. And some people, I did a cemetery tour of Melbourne once, and I was talking to the person who ran the tour and talking about the dark tourism. I was writing about a cemetery tour, a crime tour and a ghost tour in Melbourne. And she didn't see herself as a dark tourism person. She saw herself very much as a historian who was putting the Melbourne General Cemetery in the context and uncovering some of the stories, Redmond Barry, Burke and Wills, prime ministers and other people, and they did themed cemetery tours. So often we talk about it as academics as dark tourism, but in terms of the wider public, they're not necessarily talking about it in that way. But it was interesting certainly to hear how emotional Phil was about the killing fields and Les talking about the Nanjing massacre, and John talking about Nagasaki. I mean, we go there for reasons to find out more about ourselves and about the world and historical reasons, and we're not always talking about ourselves as a dark tourist.
Mm. Yeah, Nicole from Nowra, New South Wales, says, I went to Port Arthur as part of a cruise, and whilst there I visited the memorial, quietly reflected with my 17-year-old daughter. We were both sitting in silence with tears streaming down. Mm. Unfortunately, we were interrupted by a family with kids running around and moving the flowers placed there and throwing stones into the water. Personally, as much as I'm glad I saw the memorial, I do think it would be better to be preserved for the victims and their families only. And I suppose that's part of it too, is not everyone's going to have the same response. Robin's on the line. Hi, Robin.
Hi, good morning. I was in Austria in 1966. I was 24 years of age.
Right.
And I wasn't a dark tourist. I was having a carefree time. Things were good. I was travelling with an American, and we were picked up by a young Austrian driver, a really bad one, a young bloke.
Yeah.
He said, look, we've got to get out the next town. And he dropped us off, and he said, I never forgotten, he said, Mauthausen, you will not enjoy this place.
Right. What was the town called?
Mauthausen.
Mauthausen, yeah.
And it was a concentration camp, and it was the last one built, so it was the most modern.
Right.
And quite frankly, it changed the way I saw the world. It changed my... Well, I didn't have any politics, and from then on I did.
Mm. Talk to me about that, Robin. What did you see that changed your mind, and what changes were there?
Well, the thing that struck me... I mean, it wasn't long after the war. It was only 21 years after the war.
Sure.
So nothing had been... it had been cleaned.
Changed your mind, didn't
it? It had been cleaned up, but nothing had been taken away. There were no monuments. It was just simply as it was, and it had a thing that they call the dreaded Mauthausen Steps. There were 190 steps in a quarry, and they would walk the inmates down there and get them to carry huge loads up the steps and just throw it down into the quarry again until they worked them to death.
Hmm.
And they had all the guardhouses, and they had the hospitals where the experiments took place and the gas chambers. And it was absolutely bewildering. I had no idea, because World War II was a lot of flickering old movies to me. But the thing that struck me was the fellow that took us around, and they were very good, and they said, listen, remember this, this was an instrument of government policy, and it was astonishing.
Mm. And that was that the insight for you?
That was, for me, it was. And then they put up a map of Europe under the Nazis, and they had a little light for the small camps and a big light for the major ones. And through France and Germany and Austria and Poland, there was just a myriad of lights, and they explained which ones were the ones where they recycled human parts and which ones they used the gold from their bodies and stuff. There was no glaring photographs or anything, but all the stuff was there, and it literally stilled me, and I realised that there were governments in my time, and I was born in 1941, that actually used this as an exercise in government policy. And it made me quite a different person. I was 24 and, you know, pretty carefree sort of life. And this, I still was carefree, but this was the most astonishing thing. And a couple of years later, I was travelling with what was a woman that was going to be my wife. And I took her over it again. It had the same effect on her. It just brought home the realism of what had taken place very recently, actually.
Yeah.
It was almost medieval, actually.
Yeah. Yeah, interesting. Good call, Robin. Thank you. Appreciate that.
Okay.
Thanks. Okay. Thanks for sharing that. Danny, you went back to the Cambodian killing fields when you were in your 20s, did you?
G'day, Phil. I went there back in the late 90s. Honestly, I was in my early 20s with a friend of mine. I was living in Thailand, and I went over just for like a 3-day stopover, and the first thing taxi drivers all say, you want to go to the killing fields. I didn't know what we were to do or whatever. So we went along there, and it was shocking, you know, in your face, but it didn't seem real, you know. It didn't sink in. And then we stayed there, went back a couple of times, but I only visited it once anyway. A couple of years later, I met a girl in Thailand, but she was Cambodian, and I'd been reading books about Khmer Rouge and all that. She was born in 75, like same age as me. So she grew up on the Thai-Cambodian border, and I'd been to her village and seen the mum and dad, and half a family got sort of killed in the genocide and whatever. So I'm reading all these books, and she's explaining it to me. And she never got emotional when I was talking to her. And anyway, we went to Phnom Penh one time, and we went to there's a school there, a high school. I think it's called Chul Sleng S21 prison or whatever. That's where they took the prisoners there first to be processed, and they took them out of the killing fields. And there's pictures of Pol Pot on the wall and everything. And that was the first time I seen her cry. She was sitting on the photos of Pol Pot, and it sort of sunk into me because, like I said, it just never seemed real. But my wife never showed any emotion. And the Cambodians in general, they're like that. They'll tell you the stories of what happened, and I asked her once, what's the story? And there's like a saying in Khmer, and it's, if you start crying, you'll never stop. And that's why they sort of just try, they don't forget about it, but they try and put it in the past. And it's quite confronting when you've met someone who's lived through it.
Yep. Yeah, indeed. Yeah. Indeed. Thanks, Danny. Yes. Very personal story. I can imagine the feelings you must have had looking at your wife and thinking this was her people, this was her country, this was her culture. Marion's texted me saying, "Look, we think of ourselves as a lucky and safe country, but of course, we have had some pretty dark periods in our own history too, including the massacres of Indigenous people in this country." I wonder what you think about all of this. Our guest tonight, Elspeth Frew from La Trobe Business School and Leanne White from Victoria University. Leanne, to Elspeth, to you, to both of you. I mean, is there a place for that sort of tourism here in Australia, do you think?
Well, certainly we've looked into one of those sites. While the Mile Creek Massacre, for instance, mm-hmm. was a site where 28... Aboriginal people or Indigenous people were killed back in 1838. It's been recently memorialised, and I think it took until about 2001 before a headstone or a significant granite memorial stone was finally put on the site. So sometimes the acknowledgement of a past massacre, because it was certainly a significant event back in the early 19th century, takes some time before the proper respect is given to a space. But certainly in terms of our own culture, the Myall Creek massacre is one that stands out. But again, if you ask most Australians about that, they probably don't know a great deal about that particular event in our history.
Mm. And there might be an argument that we ought to know more. And that, yes, that kind of dark tourism might be a way of telling that story too.
Yeah, definitely.
Mm. Yeah, for sure. Yeah, okay. Ian, you went to Dachau.
Yeah, I went to Dachau with my wife and children. I felt that the kids sort of needed to go and have a look at a place like that.
Right, how old were the kids, Ian?
Two teenage girls, and my son was in grade 6 at the time.
Okay.
So, yeah. And immediately we walked into the compound. You could feel the oppression. And we all commented about that. You know, even the kids commented and still comment about the oppression that they felt when they walked into Dachau. And it was sort of hard to explain. And the gas chambers weren't used at that particular facility. But
No. It
was just the oppression that you kind of felt in there. And then we also, my wife and I also went to Mimbi Caves, where there was some quite a few Aboriginal people were thrown off the cliffs there. And again, that same sort of spiritual feeling,
mm-hmm.
sort of you felt just in walking in through the compounds. And a young Aboriginal fellow that took us through there, he was such a proud young man. And obviously his grandfather had a long influence on him. But it was a unique experience, I felt, as well. And then when we went to, my wife and I had an opportunity to go to, we'd already been to the Port Harper, but this was, you know, prior when the kids were little. But mm-hmm. we went back just, you know, it was after the massacre. I got to the car park, but I could not go in. I said to the kid, I cannot go in.
Yeah.
And I don't know why I felt that way, but I just couldn't walk go into the place. And I don't have ever a desire to go back there.
Yeah. No, I can well understand that, and others have had the same reaction to places that mark the Holocaust as well, that they just feel that they just can't do it. No, I well understand that. Thanks, Ian.
Yeah.
Good on you. We're talking about dark tourism and places of great sadness. Elaine, hello.
Hello, how are you?
I'm well, thanks.
Thank you. Funnily enough, I'm following on with a Port Arthur thing.
Mm-hmm.
I went on a cruise, and when we got to Port Arthur, I chose not to go into the cafe. I just didn't think it would be good. But I walked through the prison and everything else, and I kept getting this dark feeling coming down where it was tremendous sadness. And then we went on a little cruise around the other islands. And there was one island where they buried all the officials.
Mm-hmm.
But then they took us to the island of the children. And this was this little island, and kids from 13 and under were imprisoned there. I couldn't get off the ferry. Because you put your foot on the pier, and it was just like this tremendous sadness. And, you know, I've got kids, and I thought, God, if one of mine at 13 or under had been put here with no support, there was no one to look after them.
That's right.
And so many of them actually jumped off the cliff to kill themselves.
Yes, at a place called Point Pure, I think it is, isn't it?
Yeah. Yes.
Mm.
And honestly, I just, you know, I put one foot on the ferry and I said to the guy, I'm sorry, I'll stay here while everyone else does the tour, but I can't go there.
Mm. Yep, no, I well understand that, Elaine. Thank you. Just back to Elspeth and Leanne. I mean, places like I'm just thinking of the Norway attacks by Anders Breivik in 2011, where, you know, he massacred a whole lot of people on an island there. What should happen there, do you think?
Well, there should be moments in time when we reflect on what happened. So, you know, on the anniversary of that day, there should be something should happen to memorialise it. So, for example, you could have a moment's silence, you could release some doves, or you could have an unveiling of a plaque, or you know, something like that. So something significant can be done. It takes a few years for people to work out what they actually want to see at these sites. It can take many years to work out the most appropriate thing to put there. But there should be something there, because people need somewhere to go to pay their respects and to sort of quietly grieve.
Without necessarily building anything or having a memorial park or a construction site as such.
That's right. And in fact, one of the things we've noticed is that very soon after such an event happens, if you have senior people coming along to the site, it kind of reinforces that it was actually quite a significant thing that happened. So I think of the example of the Lockerbie disaster, when that happened, and they had the Prime Minister and they had members of the royal family came along just to view the site. And then every year since then, they've always had services in the local church. Mm-hmm. Simultaneously, down in Westminster in London, they have simultaneous service happening just at the moment of the explosion of the aircraft. And also in the college over in the US, which had many of the young students who were also killed at that moment too. So those kind of significant moments happen. And there can be a roll call. There can be, and often that's the case, of reading out the individual names of the people that have died. That's a very poignant thing that can happen. There can be the ringing of a bell, and the number of tolls of the bell can represent each of the people who died. So it's all about recognising and not forgetting anyone, and realising that each life was important.
Okay, back to some calls. Warren, you visited Pentridge, Warren.
Yes, hello, Phil. Nothing quite as exciting as some of the other callers you've had in this evening. But it was 20 years ago when Pentridge was closed as a penal settlement.
And this is just for those who are listening, because we're across the country, Warren. This is Melbourne's biggest jail.
Oh, that's right, yes. So it was closed as a prison, and then it was opened as a museum for a few years. And it became exceedingly popular. A lot of people went there, and I was one of them. And it was just fascinating, because for so many years, I grew up in the 70s and 80s, pardon me, and you would see Pentridge as like almost a city within a city. And it was like a forbidden city sort of thing. You drive past and wonder what sort of things were going on within the walls, the big blue stone walls. And that prison had been there since the 1850s. And so to finally be open to the public was fascinating to a lot of Melburnians, and myself included. And so and to go in there and to get a sense of what people experience within our own city, was quite moving. I remember standing in Jaika and... when I was a kid, Jaika was sort of infamous as the refuge of the worst of the worst.
That was the worst of the worst inside Pentridge, wasn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It was almost. In fact, I think later on it was almost outlawed and regarded as barbaric, because it was so inhuman that the prisoners actually had no contact with other humans at all. It was all done by sort of computers and cameras, and the inmates actually had no physical contact with the prison guards at all.
Yeah.
And at one stage, there was a revolt against the conditions, and three prisoners died. And when I was in there, you could stand in the exact spot where these three prisoners had died.
What was your own emotional response to that, Warren? I mean,
well, I was.
Was it just curiosity, or did you actually feel something a bit more emotional than that?
Well, I'll tell you, actually, Phil, it was funny, because the dates when these people died were up on the walls and these little plaques and things, and I looked at the dates and I thought where I would have been myself at that time, not that far away. And I would have been in high school. So it was 20 years ago. I'm 46 now. So it was 20 years ago when I went to Pentridge, when it was open to the public. And it was like 10 years before that, when this particular event had occurred, when these prisoners had suffocated to death and died in this very spot. And only about 20 kilometres away, I would have been in high school, goofing off being a dickhead high school student.
Yeah.
And that's what really affected me, that I thought, my God, you know, when I was just, you know, goofing off one day in maths class, these people...
Just a few hundred metres away. These people...
We're dying, that's right. Yeah,
yeah.
And suffering this horrible... And I'm sure that the people who were in prison had done some terrible things and they probably deserved to be in there, but still the fact that they were experiencing such horror that they would choose death rather than continue to live in this condition was a very sobering thought for me.
No, I can imagine it was. Yeah, thanks, Warren. Back to you, Elspeth and Leanne. Presumably it can also be done badly, can't it? Dark tourism, because it's not difficult to see how it could be made tacky. Are there any examples you can think of?
Well, yeah, there's, I suppose the tacky example that comes to mind, at least in the Australian context, is Snowtown. And
this is the town in South Australia which had the gruesome murders, yeah.
Yeah, so we had those eight bodies in the barrel, if you like, between 1992 and 1999. So John Bunting and others, and tourists come to Snowtown.
Do they?
Yes.
Because they want to see the building. They want to see the building where the barrels were.
Yeah, they're interested in seeing the bank building where it happened. And apparently a number of tourists have gone to the local shop and wanted to buy some sort of souvenir of their visit. So there was a response to that from the owner of the shop, and some magnets were produced. Fridge magnets. That basically say, come to, greetings from Snowtown, South Australia. I've been to Snowtown. It was a barrel of laughs.
Oh, really?
Barrel of fun. Words to that effect. And also the shop owner apparently had a number of ceramic barrels made, just sort of 15 centimetre small barrels that you might put toothpicks in, because, again, people were wanting to supposedly have some memory or some memento of the event. So people do take photos outside the building. There's been a few other examples that I probably don't want to talk about too much, but people do, some people do have a voyeuristic approach to that town, and apparently the school children of Snowtown wanted to rename their town Rose Town because they felt that their town had unfortunately developed a bad name, and obviously it's not a particularly big town, that town 140 kilometres north of Adelaide.
No. All right, we're talking about dark tourism. Back to some calls. Yes, Don, hi.
G'day, Philip. I'm enjoying your show.
Thank you.
I realised listening to the people going through the killing fields in Cambodia that I had some unfinished business from my career as an air traffic controller with deaths for military reasons or national security reasons here in Australia. I was an air traffic controller when Frederick Valentich disappeared over Bass Strait. And really, as an air traffic controller and knowing the intelligence harassment from both ASIO and CIA, but the only place really I have to grieve for the death of that young pilot is Cape Otway Lighthouse. I think we really need memorials for some of our own dead that have died in the Cold War, and more recently perhaps even the deaths that have died under immigration security in Christmas Island, Manus. And Nauru.
Yeah, no, Don makes a good point, doesn't he? And back to you, Leanne and Elspeth, about our own dark tourism and the fact that perhaps we've tried to sweep a bit of it away, do you think?
Yeah, in some ways. And I was just thinking, where else in Australia there are examples of dark tourism sites that are, have significance. I was thinking of Darwin.
Mm.
I was thinking in the Darwin, the new recently opened Defence of Darwin Centre, which tells us the story about what happened back in 1942 when the bombing happened by the Japanese. And I thought that was that's a really good example. Have you been there? Have you been to that?
No,
to
I've
that
not. Site? No, I've not
it's
been.
It's really
there.
Good. I would encourage you to go along. It's a really it sets in context. It shows the sort of the history of what was happening in the war at that time, and then it recreates the actual bombing itself. You go into this room and it shows you feel like you're on the ground. In Darwin, when the bombs start coming down.
Hmm.
And also, Darwin also has the Cyclone Tracy Centre, which recreates what it's like in to be in a cyclone and the experience that people have there.
Hmm.
And I think that's just two examples that I can think of the top of my head that really are fairly recent and have actually come about and really help you as an individual to understand what happened in those days.
Yeah. Yes, indeed. Murray from Surrey Hill says, I once got off the train at North Baikal in Russia and walked half a day to the site of a gulag. It was quiet and still and very reflective, so quiet that you could hear the misery. I noted the horse accommodation was better than that for the humans. It was for mining mica. Yeah, I suppose it's a way of telling stories, isn't it? Frank is on the line. Sorry, Frankie, you've been waiting on there. Sorry.
Yeah, I have.
Sorry, Frankie.
I was nearly falling asleep.
Sorry, Frankie.
No.
We've had a lot of calls tonight.
That's, yeah. I know that. No, well, I did a ghost tour at the Beechworth Mental Asylum mm-hmm. just a month ago. I stayed there for the weekend, and I found that really informative, especially for myself, because we actually have a bit of mental, illness in the family. So for me, it was very, very important that I did that tour. What astonished me was that they had the last patient there was there till I think 1995, if I'm correct.
Right.
Yeah. And just the, you know, the way.
What did you feel about it? Did you feel the sense of despair and sadness about the place? Or?
I did actually. I felt really quite sad about the whole. The way, you know, the patients were treated, it's given me, like I said, a bit of information because I had a very close member in my family hospitalised many years ago at Royal Park,
mm-hmm.
which is no longer, I don't think, it's closed down. Although someone did say to me that part of it is still going. I'm not sure. I've got no idea about that. But, yeah, no, it just gave me a lot of insight. And I was really quite, like you said, I was very saddened by the whole thing.
Hmm.
Yeah,
okay. All right, yeah, no, thank you for the call. Kim from Newport says, Phil, the most profound place I've ever visited is Hiroshima. The town hall is the only remaining building in the city. 800 metres above it, the first atomic bomb went off. But the most remarkable thing is the attitude of the Japanese people, not one hint of retribution or ill feeling on their parts. They've turned to the focus of this dreadful act into a global anti-nuclear missive. It's an amazing place, and people too. Yeah, and I have not been there, but I can imagine. Well, and people have reported to me that is the feeling when you get there. That's in a sense. Is that something we want out of dark tourism too? The feeling that there is a way out of this darkness and this madness, Leanne, Elspeth.
Yes, I think the point of people. Obviously, you know, we've heard from a range of people. Nicole and others have been to Port Arthur. Robin talking about Austria.
Mm.
Danny with the Killing Fields. But people certainly will go to places of dark tourism. It's about understanding themselves. It's about understanding the world. It's about contextualising, you know, and getting a deeper understanding of what's happened and trying to get a hold on history and hopefully not having a repeat of that incident in those cases of the more dramatic forms of dark tourism where a tragic event has happened. And you know, I certainly haven't been to Hiroshima or Nagasaki, but the very strong message, as was explained by Kim, but also when your other caller before was talking about Nagasaki as well. I'm just looking back, but that was certainly interesting that the strong message of that is let's have peace, let's go forward, let's learn from here.
Mm.
And you know, it can change your whole perspective on life and
yeah,
the move forward. So there's certainly they're managed in different ways, but I think there's an understanding of the positive going forward for the human race.
Sure. Margaret has been, you've been to Chernobyl, Margaret.
Yes, I have.
What do you actually go and look at?
Oh, well, they drive you in there and you can get out and walk around and stand and look at the big, the nuclear.
The remains of the reactor.
And, oh yes, and also through the town.
Right.
And so, you can see how they have you can see the blocks of apartments that people have just walked out of, as though they were there last week.
What? And they've all kept them, have they?
They've just been completely abandoned.
Right.
And we went into a school where there were books everywhere and children, you know, as though there'd been a class going on and the children walked out. It's starting to all disintegrate now, of course, but it was just, it was a very strange kind of a feeling to be there.
I can imagine. Mm. Yeah, I can imagine. It's apparently something of a place to go to increasingly. Yes, Dino, just briefly.
Yeah, top of the day to you. Look, I've in Germany they've mature enough to recognise their past and there's pathways and pavements. And I think I've read a book by Bruce Pascoe called Dark Emu, and it talks about when explorers came to Australia, they noticed there's huts and there was houses and dams and they were cropping and and doing all those things, and they actually had continental government going on, and it was recognised by the explorers. And I think we should mature a bit as a nation. I'm a white fella, a conservative background. I've been to Gallipoli, looked at what they got up to there, and it's time that we have a good look at our past and be proud of the great past that happened before us Westerners got here.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, it's not a bad point, Dino. I mean, it's made by some others too. Thanks for the call, and back to you, Elspeth and Leanne too. Maybe a call for us to pay more attention to our own dark history in terms of telling our national story too.
Yeah, well, certainly we've done some research into this area, and our aim would be to do further research, maybe generate some grant money. But as Elspeth was talking before, we tend to categorise them into those historic and contemporary sites of murders or massacres, and then some disasters and accidents that have happened at wartime and peacetime. So there's a whole range of categories, and even within Australia, I think there are lessons to be learned about dark tourism and incidents that have happened in our past and how this shapes us as a nation.
Sure, exactly
so
right.
So we're really interested in the national identity angle of this as well.
Yeah, exactly right. All right, well, it's been good talking with you, and I appreciate your time. Thanks to you, to Associate Professor Elspeth Threw from La Trobe Business School and Leanne White from Victoria University. Thanks to both of you for your time.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. And thanks to everybody who called tonight too. Some very moving and interesting calls too on dark tourism.
On ABC Radio, it's Nightlife with Philip Clarke.